Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we are continuing on with the school mini series with, of course, Millie Carr. How are you, Millie?
I'm really good, Jane. Thanks for having me back again.
We are not going to go into Millie's introduction because if you have not heard of Millie, you need to go back to the school mini series. I'm going to put all of the show notes into the episode. You can hear the full introduction there. We are going to continue on from the episode that we did was the great gaslighting when schools say they don't see it. And we accidentally kind of merged into the topic, which is what happens when you have ADHD. And that is IEP meetings are broken, the power struggle between parents and schools. And we went into it a little bit, but I wanted to jump back into some of the points we did miss. So, Millie, I would really love to know why schools are so defensive in the IEP meetings, because sometimes I feel like you walk in, it's like stone cold, and they open up with something like, well, you know, we can't do this for everybody. And then you're thinking, oh my God, like this isn't even warm from the beginning. Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of it comes from fear. If you acknowledge that there's something going on and that you're not potentially putting the right supports and adjustments in place, it's acknowledging that potentially that you're not doing your job as good as you think that you are. And I think a lot of the times teachers unknowingly think they're doing all the right things, but they're missing the mark with certain things. So I think a lot of it comes from just fear from the teachers to be the experts. They're meant to be the experts. They're meant to know what's going on. And if you're coming in with something that they're not sure about or they haven't been doing, questioning something they've been doing, the fear of that is often to be, and we know that is like just a response for, I know that when I'm talking to my partner about something, that defense comes when you feel like you're being attacked for something that you're not doing. So sometimes the defense goes up because they're, oh, I'm not, they know they're not doing it. So they're kind of like trying to scramble a little bit, get a bit defensive at what they are doing and try and prove to you that they're doing the right thing still. So I think fear kind of comes into a lot. I mentioned in the last episode about emotions and parents sometimes coming into the meeting a little bit emotional, which is rightful. I completely understand why you do come in. It's your child. You are extremely concerned about what's going on with them and want to change it and fix it. But coming in when you're really emotional and not having a little bit of a pre-think about it so that you don't just talk only emotionally, teachers sometimes see the emotion and kind of just, again, get defensive because they don't want to make you upset. Most teachers are not deliberately trying to do the wrong thing by your student. Teachers go into the profession mostly because they love kids and want to help. So that kind of defensiveness happens for a couple of reasons. And I think fear and sometimes that what the parent brings in kind of creates that kind of response a little bit.
Yeah, it's a great point. One of my very good friends is a family lawyer, and she said in her family law where they're doing parental rights, she hates billing people when they spend half an hour crying. And she's like, please, could you sort out actually what you want before you arrive? Because you've only got 20, 30 minutes. And if you haven't processed emotions elsewhere first, you can kind of swallow up a lot of that time with those feelings instead of actually practically what your child needs.
Yeah, with no action. Sometimes they're 15 minutes. I know I've seen meetings like this that are only meant to be 15 minutes long. And how can you possibly get anything done or talk about actions if you're just like verbalizing what you're upset about? I completely understand though, because I'm someone who's very emotional and come in really emotionally sometimes, especially if it's about a specific topic around my kids. But if you've written down, and I often get someone bring a supportive, if you're an emotional person, bring someone that's supportive that you've written down what the dot points are you want to address. If you get emotional in the middle of talking about a couple of them, maybe that person can jump in and read through it just to give you some time to get your breath back a little bit, because sometimes I completely understand being emotional, but you want to make sure you utilize those meetings good really well, because you're not going to get that time. Like they're not going to give you multiple 30-minute meetings because they just don't have time themselves either.
Oh, completely. Last episode, we went over an example that I gave around my daughter not being included in the inclusion room at lunchtime, even though it was written down part of her IEP because she didn't look upset enough or disabled enough was the feedback I received. If you'd like to know more about that and that scenario, please jump into last week's episode. If we continue on that thread, what is your go-to language for parents when schools say, we just can't make exceptions? Like, for example, that situation with my daughter or other things that you're asking for in those meetings. What kind of things can we say that you think from a teacher's perspective is positive and at least helpful to get somewhere.
I hear this all the time, and I've heard it a lot in the last month where people are being told that I can't do it for one student because then everybody else will want it. Everyone else will want the adjustment or the fidget or the sitting on the chair or being able to have a brain break when no one else is getting that. And I think something that you need to talk to the school about is about equity and equality. There's a difference between those two things, and equal means everyone gets the same, but we're not all the same. So if we're all getting the exact same thing, that's where the problems are arising. And I would bring up something like this to the teachers throughout the meeting, that everyone gets what they need. That's what equity is. And that requires teaching of the students that, because you can have kids in a classroom, and I saw it last year with a class that I work with, they got really, really angry about this particular student that was able to sit 10 minutes at the back to have a regulation kind of time before he joined the classroom again. He wasn't doing the same task as everybody else. He was also working 3-4 years below everybody else academically as well. But the kids all got really angry about it. And what I did with the teacher was work on having a language of like inclusive practice and talking about what different brains and how different brains work, and that we're all different and we all have different things that we're good at and bad at, and we all get what we need. Because sometimes the kids all think they want the fidget, but some kids are great with a fidget and some kids are not. It actually isn't a great adjustment for them because it actually doesn't work. So talking to the school about the fact that I understand what you're saying and you don't want it to look like that for the kids. However, it's actually federal law to make adjustments for my child. My child deserves these adjustments, and maybe the class need to learn about equity over equality and kind of need to do some work in that area, because I'm not accepting the fact that just because, yeah, it might upset everybody else in the class. That is the actual silliest reason I've ever heard for not giving an adjustment. If they're coming at you with that, they don't understand themselves, and they probably need to do some work too about adjustments and inequity.
I mean, could you imagine if you had a classroom, let's say you've got a child in a wheelchair and they got to, and I'm air quoting, wheelchair themselves to a different building, and imagine the children going, well, how come they get to sit in a chair and I don't? And it's like, because they can't use their legs. Like, they have a disability, but yet it's a different reaction when you're asking for something that's brain related, which is again, that visible and invisibility. I think you said it really well, because if we're teaching inclusion as a society for these children growing up to be adults, of course, nobody's going to have exactly the same thing because everyone's different. Like, of course, that's a ridiculous thing to even think that you have to make it completely equal. In those moments, aren't we teaching our children's inclusion? That's different needs.
Exactly. And that's where teachers need to actually work. They need to actually do that and create an environment that's really inclusive by actually talking to kids about inclusion, about difference, about everyone getting different things. And if you're not going to do that, then that's where problems happen in the classroom. So the teacher probably is going, saying that, thinking it's going to cause issues. It's going to cause issues in a classroom that hasn't had those conversations and haven't talked about neurodiversity and different brains. And the fact that we all have different brains, it's the same as having, we have different flowers and we water different flowers and treat them differently. However, with different brains, it's like, well, no, we all have to learn this particular way. Well, that's absolutely ridiculous. And I think kids really get it once you actually talk about it in that way. When you reframe it, the fact that it's just natural diversity to have a different brain and everyone has different kind of supports and things that they need, then they start making choices for themselves about, oh, I know that I learn best like this, and I can advocate for the fact that I need that thing, and building those things into the classroom. If we're going from it, who's not doing this at all, that's the other end of the spectrum that is not going to happen probably for that teacher at that time. But that's what we want to build towards, creating classrooms like that where teachers are never saying stuff like that, because that's just a silly thing to say and you can squash it really quickly. And then you mention again the federal law. You've mentioned the fact that it's actually in federal law to actually make reasonable adjustments for my child.
Oh, I love that. We're going to put in the show notes to federal law that you're quoting. Sometimes when we're having these discussions, it can end really great. And everybody can be happy, all parties. It can end like that, and that's great. However, it can also not end like that, and you can end up in a position where you wish you had have documented something differently, because that would have helped you in, let's say, your fight to stay at that school or whatever it is that you're asking for. What would be some examples of documents that parents need or should be thinking about if they do end up in a legal case?
I would be asking the parents, if your child is getting adjustments, you need to have a particular IEP plan that has their goals and what adjustments that the teachers are making, notes from any meeting that you have. So making sure you're collecting notes from any meeting that you're having with the teacher about the adjustments, how they're working, how they're tracking, and all the evidence that goes into that. If you're able to have diagnosis notes and things from medical professionals such as pediatricians and OTs, speech psychologists, that's absolutely fabulous. Not every parent has access to these things, and it doesn't mean that your child doesn't deserve to have adjustments as well. So we still make adjustments as teachers for students that don't have a formal diagnosis. You do not need a formal diagnosis for many states. So each state has a different way of giving out funding, but you don't necessarily for a lot of different states actually need a diagnosis. It's needs-based. So in Victoria, for instance, that's where I work, we are able to, as teachers, recommend a student, even if they don't have a diagnosis, to go forward for a disability inclusion profile, which is a bit of a meeting. We have four different kind of areas that we look at, and we say whether we've got substantial or extensive adjustments. And then we go through from there with what kind of things we need. So anything that they're doing in relation to that, make sure you've got those evidence as well, things that go into the different categories for the disability inclusion as well. And then, yeah, like I said, thinking about medical professional notes as well. All of that kind of forms together to give you a really nice picture of what the school is doing for your child, what you're doing, and then if you need to take any next steps, I guess, after that as well.
Oh, I love that. I think that's great. I always seem to talk about my daughter when I speak to you because it's always, we're talking about the internalizing, hey. So yeah. I remember we had already moved schools from the shitty public school that I talked about in the last episode. We moved to a private school that actually one of my best friends worked in the classroom at. And so I just went in with a trusted, like my best friend basically is going to be in the classroom with her. So I'm just going to go there. And that's where we went. But the problem with some of those private schools is that they do that transition to high school in grade three. There's a lot more academic pressure. And that transition to grade three, which I knew was the transition to high school, I had been prepared. It was going to be a difficult transition. She gets into the first day of grade three. We've only done an hour and a half inclusion plan with her grade two teacher. So I had this great inclusion plan. We had a tricky transition and I had requested a specific teacher who I thought would be the best of not a great year level. Getting there first day, the first thing they did was single her out in front of the class, the whole group, and say, why do you have that sensory toy? And removed it from her. Now, I had already been made aware that the inclusion head at that school was not very good with admin and they probably wouldn't spread that inclusion plan and email it. So I'd already emailed it to every teacher possible, including her class teacher, who had confirmed that she'd received it. They immediately singled it out, removed her sensory toy, which then immediately she went to the office with a stomach ache because, of course, anxiety hits. She's got her toy removed, which she's always used responsibly. Literally, it would have just been in her hand. And I felt very, very, very angry. That was the first day of grade three. And I was wondering, in terms of real world consequences and schools not following, honouring, sending the IEP around, I felt livid with rage that I'd spent so much time on this and then it wasn't read on the first day by the teacher. Like, what else do they have to do than read the IEPs? She was there a week before. So what do you think some of the consequences are when schools just don't even read or use the IEPs?
Unfortunately, this is something that I'm actually really upset about. There isn't enough consequences for this kind of behaviour because it requires a lot of effort from yourself to actually grab all of that written documentation that you've got, everything that you've put in place, diagnosis. You're going to have to go forward into different kind of avenues, go to the Department of Education and go further to address this. And that's going to cost you a lot of time and a lot of effort to do that. And a lot of people don't go down that path because it's just so much effort. And what they do instead is take their student out, ask for a different teacher. Those kind of things get done. And that's something that I'm really passionate about at the moment is that there actually isn't a proper mandate around that actually like forces them to follow these things. So the policies are there in place. Like the policies are there. Most states have an inclusion policy. The Australian government as a whole has an inclusion policy. The policies are there. Like there are policies there Some states are better than others. I'm going to preface that though, because I know that there are some states that are leading the way and falling behind with some of these inclusion policies. But even with those policies being made, there's only so much that the Department of Education can do at the moment, or to even be aware that it's even happening. So a lot of places wouldn't even be aware that was happening to you, Jane, because if you haven't taken it further, it just falls away and there's not much to go about it. So that's why we need to, even though it costs so much energy and effort, keep all that documentation and try and take it further and address it so that you can get those complaints to the Department of Education and they have that data. And then there's people like yourself and I who are speaking about it. We're just trying to get the government to create something that's mandated as a checkpoint to make sure that everyone's addressing these things. If you've created an inclusion plan and it hasn't been shared and your students then had some kind of harm or exclusion, basically she's been excluded because of having her fidget and she was then sent because she had anxiety and stomach pains, that there needs to be something there as a Australian government. This is like federally that needs to be in place to monitor that these policies are being followed. Because at the moment, there really actually isn't anything concrete. And there needs to be something a little bit more concrete to actually make sure that schools individually, and this is across Catholic, public, and independent schools, are all following this as well. Sometimes independent schools have their own kind of, they don't have to follow anything exactly from the government. There's some, obviously, the Discrimination Act and the Disability Standards for Education. They're the ones that, they're the federal laws. But apart from that, what processes they put in place and the different meetings they have, they create them themselves, each independent school. There isn't anything that completely mandates them as much as public schools, but even then, public schools the same. There's not enough mandating of these things so that, yeah, something like your problem, Jane, you can actually go further and actually have it stop really quickly. It will take a lot of effort from you to actually get this kind of actually listened to. And I'm hearing stories like yours, Jane, across the whole of Australia so much. There's so many people that are commenting and talking about the fact that this is happening to them. And yeah, it's just really not good enough. And the Australian government kind of need to act a little bit to make something more concrete, because the policies are there, but it's not good enough to have a piece of paper that actually doesn't show that the teachers and the classrooms and the schools are following what actually is written down in the policy.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think you've made a great point, because even if maybe the complaint doesn't go anywhere and maybe it can't be fixed because it's already happened, but documenting it and creating pressure, even if we feel like it's not going anywhere, does create data, because people not saying anything, then there's no problem. I mean, the government will be lucky to act if there is a documented problem, let alone if everybody just doesn't bother.
Yeah. We all need to band together and speak up on it, because when you've got, it's obviously numbers, the bigger the numbers complaining about this, then they'll be like, oh my God, there actually is a problem. At the moment, it's almost like they think that, I don't know whether they even are aware of how deep the problem actually is. And some of the stories, there are stories like what you just said, Jane, so many stories exactly like what you just say, what you're just saying, that happen every year with so many students, and it's just not really okay. So in my opinion, it's not really okay. And if you're documenting it, make sure you're documenting it. That just puts pressure on the school in the first place. Sometimes documenting things will make the school go, oh, shivers, I've got to smarten up here and make sure I'm following it. Or even the threat of going further, the threat of going further and taking some legal action against not abiding by federal law, that's something that potentially might get a school to act. It won't get every school to act, unfortunately, because there are varying levels of understanding in different schools, but I would definitely document everything and then mention those things in the meeting, just to give them a little bit of a scare that you're not playing games here. This is actually really serious and you're going to take this further. You know what you're talking about. Teachers don't know. They don't even know about these Disability Discrimination Acts and these kind of federal laws. They're actually not aware of it either. Putting that forward to them and knowing that is going to be your little bit of ammo to get them to potentially do something.
Yeah. And from the teacher's point of view, that if they're not even aware of that, then you can understand why that's not being then implemented. And that's up to the school and the Department of Education to educate their teachers better. It's not the teacher's fault if they don't know. So then maybe it will create change to create the training for the teachers. That may be where it starts. But I've loved this episode, Millie. We will catch you again next week. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And we're going to put all of the federal legislation into the show notes.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD month shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.